Okay, today is Wednesday, April 17th. I'm Hillary Domish. With me again is Sarah Hunter-Liskowski, and we are in Placitas, New Mexico, for day two of Chris Enke's oral history. And yesterday we kind of got to a point where you were talking about the transition from being an electrochemist to looking more at automated instrumentation.
Right.
And we wanted to hear about how the transition was from electroanalytical chemist to automated instrumentation to mass spec, and start getting a little bit more into how you got involved in the mass spec research.
Right. So, as I mentioned, the digital equipment had come out with the PDP-8. A colleague of mine at Dick Nicholson at Michigan State had gotten one of these. This was a laboratory computer, but it was still in a big electrical rack, you know, 6 feet high, 2 feet wide, and so on, 2 feet deep. But it was on rollers, and you could move it around. It was exciting for me because it really brought the capability of data collection, data interpretation, right into the laboratory. Up until that time, people would collect their data, enter them manually into punch cards, and carry them over to the campus computer in order, and then write programs in Fortran or something to do the data analysis. It also, because I understood the electronics of what was going on inside the computer, I realized there was a bus in there that was just passing data from one place to another, and if I could get access to that bus and make the appropriate interface, would be able for the computer to get the information directly. So that would eliminate that whole readout step. Then I realized, too, that if in fact the data could be read directly into the computer, not only that, if I could get the information that was on the computer bus out to the instrument, I could use I could write programs in which the computer would be telling the instrument what to do. So this was an exciting time. I developed some one of the things that we did in the second generation of digital equipment's PDP-8, which now had came down to sort of almost what you might call desktop. It was sort of the transition between individual transistors and integrated circuits for digital equipment. Again, we were still working with Heath Company. We were still upgrading into the modern era, and we built an interface that plugged directly into the PDP-8 bus and gave external access to that bus. So it was really the forerunner of now what you buy from National Instruments for interfacing equipment to experiments to the computer and controlling them. Of course, we didn't have LabVIEW program, so we had to develop that ourselves. But it was pretty exciting, and we did electrochemical experiments under interface control, and then we started to do optical. So and I realized that one of the things that the computer was very good at was handling large amounts of data, larger amounts than you could get onto a strip chart recorder. So I got interested in the Vidicon camera, which is the precursor now of all the CCDs and things that are in cameras. and we did some work on polarization and other kinds of optical things. One of the things that intrigued me about computer control of instruments is that when an experimenter does an experiment, they'll set up the experiment, run it, review the data, decide what to do next, and go then do another experiment. Well, I realized too that it was possible for the computer to do some of that interpretation and decide what to do next based on the information that it had just gotten from the experiment. Now, this could happen in sub-millisecond time, yeah, as opposed to the next day time, which is the usual for experimental operations. So that really intrigued me. And I gave you an example yesterday of a simple example of how that worked in the case of emission spectroscopy, mm-hmm, sort of not spending any longer than you needed to and to collect the data that you want. I conceived the idea of a universal analytical instrument. And I also thought, and this is something we still don't have, but my vision was that you wouldn't tell the computer what it is it was supposed to do, what the experiment was supposed to do. You would tell the computer what it is you wanted to know. And so now I'm getting, I want the computer to be involved in looking up what the specific characteristics of your target analyte is, looking up the characteristics of the matrix in which it's found, devising an experiment, devising an analysis and carrying it out. So in order to carry out that analysis then, there will be two principal functions. One is separation and the other is identification. I mentioned yesterday that analytical chemistry measurements, the principal problem is the fact that what you're looking for is mixed up with everything else. So you have to first find the distinguishing characteristic and use it to sort of bring that analyst and that analyte up to the fore. And so I needed a method of separation, and then I needed a method of identification. Now, the method of separation, as you both very well know, everybody uses and was already in full swing at that time, is chromatography. Mm-hmm. But chromatography was not going to be useful to me because you can't just go look at any peak whenever you want to. You have to wait until it happens.
Right.
And so this is not a real-time method, and I wanted real-time. So I wanted to be able to take a mixture and separate it into parts and then pick out one of those parts at will and identify it. And at that point, so I had this pretty well in mind, and at that time, a new graduate student came into the group, Rick Yost, and he decided he'd like that project. So we went to a fax meeting, I think it was, in Cincinnati.
I'm sorry, what meeting?
FAACS or FACCS, it's now called SCICS. But anyway, it was an analytical meeting of the local kinds. And we were driving back to East Lansing. It was evening, and some of the students were already asleep. And we were trying to keep each other awake, and so we started to talk about how we were going to accomplish the separation. And Rick was there, and Rick had worked with Bonner Denton at the University of Arizona as an undergraduate, and had some experience with Bonner with a quadrupole mass analyzer. And he said, well, maybe we could use a quadrupole mass analyzer to do the separation, because you could pick any given mass out of the mess of masses at the beginning and transfer it onto the next thing. You just set it for that mass and it would do that. And that sounded good, but then we need a method of identification. Well, you can't just put another mass spectrometer there to identify, because all you're going to get is the mass of what you just separated out. There's going to be no new information, right? So we realized that what we needed to do in order to identify then the particle that we, the mass, the ion that we had separated, was we were going to have to fragment it so it would give us a characteristic fragmentation pattern, which is the usual mass spectrum. So we needed a way to fragment ions between two mass analyzers. So we're looking into the literature, and there is, people had been fragmenting ions for a little while between the magnetic and electric sectors of double focusing mass spectrometers. And they were not using this for analytical purposes at all. Yet they were using it to study the fragmentation process, what it took to fragment the ions and so on. There was more fundamental physical chemistry kinds of investigations. And Bynum was involved in this, and Graham Cooks, and so we recognized Graham Cook's name, and Graham came to Michigan State one time as a, right while we were trying to sort all this out, he was an outside advisor, consultant, or reviewer for the Mass Spec Center that was in the biochemistry department at Michigan State. And he was coming to campus, and so Rick and I had breakfast with him one morning when he was there, and we presented this problem to him, and what was known at the time was that the efficiency of this fragmentation, what they did was they would just have a little gas leak between the two sectors. If they put in too much gas, the signal just disappeared completely. If they put in just enough, of course, most of the ions missed getting collided. And so the efficiency was pretty poor. And not only that, the efficiency dropped off dramatically as the ion energy decreased. So someone, in fact, and I've been trying to locate this paper, Rick and I both have, but I remember it distinctly, someone even plotted the efficiency of fragmentation as a function of voltage, and it just tanked when you got below. It wasn't very good at 3,000 volts. It was pretty bad at 1,000 volts, and below that, it was like, never mind. So Graham suggested one possibility was to, you know, in a quadrupole, the ions are going at maybe 10 or 20 electron volts, not thousands. So he suggested maybe one way that we could do this is accelerate them up to the high voltage so we could get efficient fragmentation, and then decelerate them into the before they went into the next quad. And so we wrote a proposal to NSF, and to build this tandem quadrupole instrument. We admitted in the proposal that we needed a means of fragmenting the ions in between these two analyzers, and that this was going to be a novel part of the research. And we presented the possibility of this acceleration, deceleration plan that Graham had suggested. That was a little disappointing suggestion because obviously that had occurred to us too, and it didn't seem like it was probably going to be very efficient. We're going to lose a lot of lines in the acceleration and deceleration, and it already wasn't very efficient. So the other possibility was to use energetic electrons to fragment the ions, and we presented both of those possibilities. The proposal got horrible reviews. It was just one of the main criticisms was that we were total unknowns in mass spectrometry, and if any, this was a complicated problem, and if anyone was going to solve it, people who knew what they were doing would do it. And so that and the other was that there was really no recognition for the analytical need for this. It was already going on in sector instruments, so why? And so so the proposal was badly received. We also sent, later we sent a copy, or maybe around that same time, to the Office of Naval Research. Now, part of the proposal was that I now realize that now the National Instruments 4004 microcomputer had first come on. It was a tiny little bit of very low power processing, but you could do it. And I thought, now really the way to run this instrument control is to have a little microprocessor in charge of a separate little microprocessor in charge of each part of the operation. We'll put one in charge of this quadrupole, one in charge of this quadrupole, one in charge of the voltages, and so on. And we'll arrange a communication scheme among them. And with the main processor, still the PDP-8, which is running all of this. And so we had this, which is now called distributed intelligence concept, for running this complicated instrument. Now, the Office of Naval Research didn't really care at all about the mass spectrometry, but they were really intrigued by this distributed intelligence kind of thing. And so they funded us $25,000 a year. And now, building a mass spectrometer from scratch, I mean, they didn't have a mass spectrometry lab. It was the first vacuum thing I'd ever done. So there were vacuum pumps and vacuum gauges and interlocks and all of this kind of stuff, these expensive pieces. So we were scrounging and working to try to get this together at the same time, working on the electronics part of it and so on. Went to an ASMS meeting, and that was in mm-hmm. 1977. Rick and I went to the mass spectrometry meeting. I for the first time, Rick for the second. Now we had money and we had this, and I didn't know anybody particularly in the mass spectrometry community. So and the meeting was still fairly small. There were just a few hundred people who were attending ASMS at that time. And I noticed among the attendees Jim Morrison. Now Jim Morrison, as you know from your research, is an Australian. But I had met him at Princeton. He came to Princeton to do, as a visiting prof, it turns out, and ended up doing some work with a friend and colleague of mine, George Leroy. And so I met Jim and his wife, and we hit it off, and we had we had several nice interactions there. So when I saw Jim Morrison's name on the program at ASMS, I thought, great, here's somebody at least I know and I can talk to. So Rick and I and Jim Morrison and Austin were hofting. It turns out that Jim Morrison had an adjunct appointment at this point with our visiting professor appointment at the University of Utah. And he would come and spend winters here, or summers, anyway, whatever. He would come in and spend some time just about every year at the University of Utah. So he and Austin were sharing a room, Rick and I were sharing a room. After dinner, we went back to Morrison and Laura Hoftig's room, and we're sitting around and talking. And so Jim says, Chris, you're not a mass spectroscopist, what are you doing here? And so we explained to him what it is we're trying to accomplish, and that we had this problem of trying to get ions fragmented between two quadrupole mass analyzers. And he said, wow, you know, I don't know. Well, Jim, what are you doing? Well, he says, as a matter of fact, I have two quadrupole mass analyzers put together, and I'm studying photodissociation. And so what I'm trying to do is use photons to dissociate the ions between these two analyzers. He wanted to do, he's a physical chemist, and he wants to do this to study the process of photodissociation. He's not thinking of this as an analytical technique at all. He's very interested in photodissociation, and he wants to, he's got his, and he says, I've got my laser line collinear down the beam running through, and I have a quadrupole between, I have a separate quadrupole to collect the fragmented products. Well, that was interesting. And then he said, it's really not efficient. He said, despite, you know, my pulse laser and all the rest of it, he says, I have to use synchromistor modulation. Do you know what that is?
I don't.
Okay. It's that you pulse the laser, and then you time your detection in synchronicity with the pulse of the laser, so that you can see the little extra bump in synchronous time that you get from the pulse laser. And he said, that's what I have to do in order to sort the ions that my photons are making from all the background. And I said, what background? What do you have for background? He says, I have fragment ions when the light's off. I said, I want those. We realized what something was going on in his instrument that was producing fragment ions from the ions he was selecting in his first quadrupole, and it was doing it at a rate that was troubling to him, that was huge, in fact, compared to his intended method. Well, we spent the rest of the evening trying to figure out why that was happening, because he believed, right along with everyone else, you needed thousands of volts to get any kind of efficiency in fragmentation. So we were thinking, is the RF in that center quadrupole somehow or another giving them enough energy, or what is it that's going on? And so I couldn't sleep that night. It was really an incredible time. I said, my God, that's it. I woke up the next morning, I said, Rick, you're going to Australia. And so we got Jim, and we said, Jim, we just really love it if Rick could come to Australia and we could run some experiments on this machine and study this fragmentation process that's going on without the light. And he said, gosh, that'd be terrific. So we arranged it.
No, sorry, can I interrupt?
Sure,
before Rick went to Australia, when you were that first night at ASMS, yeah, just talking about this, Did Austin Verhofstadt have any contribution to this? I mean, because he was also involved in mass spec, and obviously he was at ASMS, but
yeah.
The work he was doing at Utah.
Right. I don't remember him having any substantive input. I know he was enjoying the conversation and chiming in from time to time, but I don't remember that. Jim agreed for Rick to come to Australia to do experiments. Of course, we didn't have any money for him to make such a trip. So I got a hold of the program director at ONR, who had funded our, and I said, can you get Rick on some maybe plane flying out there or something? He said, wow, that's a really unusual request. I don't know. I told him what was going on and what I thought was at stake here, and he said, I'll get back to you. And so he called back the next day and supplemented our grant with enough money for Rick to make that trip out there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that was a really nice thing. And Rick went out there. One of Morrison's many contributions to mass spectrometry was the initial development of the program called SEM-ION, which is the ion trajectory simulation program everybody uses to this day. And they did SEM-ION experiments to try to see whether the RF was giving enough kick to these ions to bring them up to fragmentation voltage levels, and it wasn't. Nowhere near it. 10, 20, 30 volts maybe, possibly max, is all they could figure out that it was getting. So what was happening? Nevertheless, what they did was we want to do collisional dissociation in this middle quadrupole that's in Jim's machine. And in order to do that, you've got to introduce collision gas. And that puts gas pressure inside the mass spectrometer, which is not a good thing. Particularly, it messes up the if you get a collision while you're in the process of doing a mass analysis, that hurts that part, but also at some point your detector is going to get hurt. And so they brought the pressure up about as far as they could manage and got really nice fragmentation efficiency out of that. And so Rick came back with data. And we then set out to write a paper. We wrote a paper and submitted it to JAX. I sent a copy off to Graham asking for his comments before I submitted it. I'm still trying to figure out why I thought to do that. Whether it was insurance or because he was such a nice guy and we'd had such a great conversation and so on, I'm not sure. But at any rate, he sent me back some comments and we revised the paper when we sent it in, it was already with Graham's blessing. And then the reviews came back, and one of them was clearly Graham's because it was exactly the same comment that we had already seen. And the other one was scathing. Just absolutely, why do you know this? This is impossible. These data are wrong. This can't be happening. This is, you know, and besides, so you need to do these other experiments. This was just a letter. I wrote back a rebuttal that was longer than the letter that we had submitted, and the editor playing Graham off against another person accepted the paper.
Do you recall who was editor of JAX at the time? Who was?
I looked that up the other day, and I did discover it wasn't who I thought it was. And I don't remember the name.
Okay, well, we can look that up.
I think I may be able to check on that later if you'd like. yeah. So he accepted the paper and we published. And then we published another paper with Morrison. filed a patent disclosure. And the patent disclosure, Michigan State didn't know what to do with it, so they sent it to the Research Corporation. A Research Corporation looked at it, and then they called me up. It's quite a lot of work to file a patent disclosure, it turns out. And it was quite a lot of extra work to do it through Research Corporation because they had a much more extensive form to fill out in order to do all of this. And so they called me up one day and said, Professor Anker decided not to pursue this. And I said, okay, no. But, because I didn't really care about the patent, I've never gotten involved in patents before on things. I don't think so. Anyway, but I said, this took quite a lot of time. So before I do this again, please tell me what criteria you use in determining whether something's patentable or not, or whether you will think it's going to be worthwhile to patent it. And they said, well, we don't like things that are just minor improvements over something that's already there, because then we don't have the core patent. I said, well, I understand that. He said, what we're looking for is something that's a really breakthrough idea. And I said, oh, okay, well, how do you test that? And he said, well, we go out to people who are using similar technology and ask them if they would find this worthwhile. And I said, well, but if it's really, really new, how are they going to know? If it's going to do something they've never done before, how will they know how valuable it is? And he said, you know, I'll get back to you. So he called back a week later and he said, we've decided to go ahead. So it very nearly didn't get patented. Now, the thing is, and this is really, really important, the patent is not for the triple quadrupole. Jim Morrison already had a triple quadrupole, and the people who are writing the patent already know this. What was patented was the fact that you could achieve efficient fragmentation of ions at low collision energy. When you do it in a quadrupole container. Okay, so that really was the patent. The patent described the application of this between a quadrupole primary analyzer and a quadrupole secondary analyzer. So the configuration that was patented was the triple quadrupole, but the innovation, the novelty, was not the triple quadrupole, it was the a low energy ion fragmentation process intentionally done for the purpose of chemical analysis. Now that was what was new. And that's what a lot of people don't really understand and why there's quite a lot of controversy. They think the patent was on the triple quadrupole and it shouldn't have been because there already was one.
Right.
this low-energy collision process is the cornerstone of all tandem mass spectrometry instruments today, still. All MSMS instruments use low-energy fragmentation. It doesn't matter whether they're ion traps that do it sequentially in the same trap or whether it's serially in space among with quadrupole, collision cell, time-of-flight, or time-of-flight, collision cell, time-of-flight, It's all low energy collision fragmentation because it's efficient, because it's effective. And that was what the breakthrough was. So the entire MSMS industry depended on this one.
What was the response like from the rest of the mass spec community? I mean, you said that, you know, I mean, the review from Graham, obviously you worked with him a little bit to kind of make sure that some of those questions in the paper were answered. But the other reviewer was scathing and said that this couldn't be.
Yes.
And certainly the people that the research corporation went to say, would you use this? Does it make sense? They didn't really get it or believe it to be true either necessarily.
Right.
So, you know, how did you deal with the response from the mass spec community, and how did they slowly, or did they slowly come about to?
It wasn't so slow.
Okay.
What happened was, and this is really pretty interesting. We published a paper and went to the next ASMS meeting in St. Louis. And we were presenting, we were given a terrific spot on the program. Which was the middle of the last morning of the meeting. Most people had gone by then.
Yeah.
And, but nevertheless, we got on the program and gave our talk, gave the talk on this, and we were still now in the process of building the instrument. We came back and now we know exactly what we want to do. We need baffles here and another quadrupole and so on, and we're in the process of trying to get this instrument built. So we're reporting on the data that Rick had gotten in Australia. We had some fun. We were sitting around the pool outside and overhearing a conversation that was taking place, and we had a couple of chairs away, say, "Do you know what some guys have done?" They've stuck two quarter poles in there, you know, and it was really fun listening to that conversation. And that was neat. But then we gave the paper. Didn't really know much about the response. There were only a few people in the audience and so on. But then, about 2 weeks later, I think it was, and Rick Stahl has this letter, about 2 weeks later, we got a letter from Don Hunt, University of Virginia. Don Hunt opened it up, and here's a collision spectrum. It works. And boy, did that light a fire.
Yeah.
He had a really, really bright person working in his lab, Jeff Shabanowitz. And Jeff destroyed three operating quadrupoles and stuck them together to make this work, and got it done in just a couple of weeks.
Wow.
And he was off and running, and Don was starting to publish analytical papers, you know, identifying this particular part of a mixture of crude oil, for heaven's sakes. I mean, it was really, really nice. And and it also turns out that Graham went immediately back to the lab, and he didn't have three quadrupoles, but he wasn't sure he really needed that middle one, and so he had stuck two quadrupoles together and was trying to work this. I mean, it just went viral. And I realized that that I really needed to get going. This was going to be, I could lose it quickly. And so So we did. You know, there were a lot of interesting little things. It seems so obvious in hindsight. But how do you get a normal spectrum when you have a tandem mass spectrometer? How would you get just a normal mass spectrum? The way that they did it in the sector instruments was that they had a little deflector that they could turn on in a second detector that they put right after the first analyzer. So if you wanted just an ordinary spectrum, you sent the beam off that way. And if you wanted your tandem spectrum, you send it through. And we were trying to figure out how to put in this second detector and what to do and so on. And then one morning I realized we didn't have to do that. All we had to do was run the third analyzer in RF only mode so all the ions would get through, and it didn't matter whether they were fragments or not. They started out as the mass you selected, and you could get a mass spectrum without any problems. Well, now it's like, duh. But at the time, you know, there was just those little things that we kept, because when you're in an area where something is totally new, a lot of the things that you learned are in the way.
Right.
And so, anyway, so then it went hot. It went hot, and Graham and Don and I were on the stump at just about every meeting, which was good, and we were able to keep up, and we wrote some definitive papers on doing ion structure, organic structural analysis using the tandem quadrupole, because you could do hard ionization in the first, and then get all the normal mass spec fragments, and then you could fragment those. So then you could see which subfragments the fragments came from, and it shortened the whole process of organic structural analysis, just collapsed, you know, 6 months worth of work into an experiment.
Wow.
So that was nice. And then the mixture analysis work was good too. Other people were way ahead of us. They had operating quadrupole instruments. They had instruments that had been designed. They had ion sources that were commercial. We were still hobbling along with homemade stuff. So it was hard for us to keep up at that time because other people had who were already in the mass spec area were able to get their instruments were more versatile than ours. But at any rate, we did. And so that's what that. Now it turns out, interestingly, that Morrison's was not the only triple quadrupole that existed at that time. When Morrison went to for one of his first trips to Utah, he was talking to a moment here. Gene Futrell.
Oh, okay.
Gene had been studying ion molecule reactions and was interested in the ion fragmentation process, collisional fragmentation. He'd been doing this with sectors. And so when Jim met Gene, and he suggested, and at this point, Jim's triple quadrupole instrument was a conception in his mind. He hadn't actually built it yet, but he was planning this. He had it in mind to do this. So he suggested to Gene, maybe you'd like to use this approach for your ion fragmentation studies. And Gene apparently thought that was a good idea, so he built a triple quadrupole. But in fact, he didn't use it for ion fragmentation study, collisional fragmentation studies. He used it for what Morrison was trying to use it for. He suddenly got interested in photo dissociation and thought he would do that. So he basically built a competing instrument with Jim Morrison's, and and published first.
Oh wow!
And so, but Morrison didn't know about that paper. He was still working it out, and he published. The instruments are somewhat different, and both of them were present in that history that I that. Historical chapter that I sent you.
Mm-hmm.
And so then he knew he had the same background problem that Morrison had. I've talked to him since. He said it was awful. He knew it was from collisional dissociation, but he didn't care. I mean, it was a problem. He gave, he was so disenchanted with the instrument that he gave it to Mar Vestal.
Oh, yeah.
And then Vestal went off to Houston, I think, and and took the instrument with him. Vestal, somebody told me the other day, I think, or maybe I read it, Vestal said that he knew that collisional dissociation was causing all those background ions, and he thought they were a royal pain in the ass. So, I think this, we were talking yesterday about how different kinds of chemists think about things in a different way. Here is a really prime example. Okay. I mean, if the, because Marvin and Futrell, Morrison, all physical chemists. They're studying this physical process. They want it neat and clean. They don't want anything else going on. They want to be able to study just that one interaction that they want to characterize. So the fact that that there was something else going on there that would be of tremendous benefit in the analytical application of tandem mass spectrometry never clicked. See? And I think it, there is a way that people think differently. So I came into this from one side needing a process, you see, that was already there in a way, but hadn't been exploited and hadn't been developed to optimize, to be optimized. Mm-hmm. And they had, so anyway, so then what happened, Fred McLafferty grabbed me at an ASMS meeting and said, Chris, what's going on here? This can't be, this is, you, where is this fragmentation coming from? And so on, he was quite upset. And because he was building at that time, and in fact had, this is interesting, he was one of the problems with the tandem mass spectrometry in the sector instrument was that the magnetic sector had resolutions of 1,000 or 2, the electric sector had resolutions of 20 or 30. Not good. Together, they made a high-resolution mass spectrometer, but separately, they were not superb. So one of them, you had pretty good resolution, and the other one not. And you could arrange it, you could put the electric sector first and have poor resolution of your precursor and good resolution of the product, or the other way around, but you couldn't get good resolution of both. And that's the thing that really got people excited about the triple quarter pole, because you got good resolution of both. All of a sudden, in a simple instrument. recognizing this, the resolution problem of where would you rather have your poor resolution, you know, for the precursor or the product, recognizing that this was a problem, McLafferty was designing a tandem double sector instrument. So he was going to have electric magnetic and then the collision cell and then the electric magnetic and so on, and had actually gone to Australia and spent time with Morrison right next to his triple quarter pole, designing, using semion to design his tandem instrument. But he didn't recognize that what he was trying to accomplish was already going on right next to him either. It was waiting for us, I guess.
So it seems like you went from, you're talking about, when you're initially thinking about this, you and Yost are unknowns in mass spec. And you're going from unknown to kind of at the middle of people just really taking hold of this technology and, you know, trying to do whatever they can with it. So it's, you know, it kind of skyrockets in a very short time.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I remember when we were trying to tell Jack Holland, who was in the mass spec facility in the biochemistry department at Michigan State, where we were trying to accomplish. He said, "You're nuts. You've got to crawl before you can walk. You can't just do this, you know, complicated thing in a field you don't know anything about." So you're right. I mean, it was, and curiously, here's another little sort of psychological twist. Rick was accepted as a mass spectroscopist right away because he did his thesis in mass spectrometry. I didn't, so I wasn't. I had to battle my way into the area. Now, mass spectroscopists are a wonderful bunch. They really are absolutely fantastic. Warm, accepting, sharing. Really, really terrific. Just virtually to a person. And so it wasn't that much of a struggle, but certainly getting funding, it was. Getting our first paper published, it was.
Yeah.
But after that, things died out.
Now, did you know any of the people from your experiences at PitCon? Had you interacted with any of the people from ASMS just kind of casually at PitCon? Because I know there is great overlap between people who attend ASMS and people who attend PitCon.
Yeah. No, because I wasn't interested in mass spectrometry before.
Right.
Before we got into it, in fact, mass spectrometry wasn't really a central part of analytical chemistry even at that time. There was electrochemistry, chromatography, and that was basically it. Electrochemistry and chromatography, spectroscopy. Sorry, mm-hmm. There was no. Those were the three areas that were covered in analytical chemistry. And mass spectrometry now, of course, is central, but at the time, it was the analytical application of mass spectrometry wasn't very big. Petroleum industry was using it for kind of empirical identification of different types of crude. It really wasn't a strong analytical tool. Organic chemists use it for structural analysis, basically, because you get the fragmentation pattern of the molecules that your ions that you make. Wasn't very sensitive, wasn't very efficient. It really took MSMS to put mass spectrometry on the analytical scene. And that's and I've been a happy mass spectroscopist ever since.
So, I mean, it sounds like the mass spec community was really excited about this pretty quickly.
Yes.
After kind of that first attempt at getting funding, after that first paper,
yeah.
was it easier to get funding? Were the other papers more easily accepted by the journals?
It was easier to get funding, but it was still very difficult to get an instrument.
Okay.
and so, I mean, it was hard to get somebody to cough up several hundred thousand dollars for an instrument. I have to say, instrumentation, building new instruments has been a very, very difficult funding game all along. It's much easier to get funding to solve a particular problem with an existing technique than it is to be developing new techniques. There's the one of the problems is you don't have an immediate payout goal in sight. The other is it's somewhat risky. The other is there's just a perception among some people of tinkering,
right.
And so it's a hard game, and it's also a hard game because you can spend tons and tons of student months just battling trivial problems, problems that aren't going to get your paper, because they're just practical engineering kinds of problems. Yeah.
Now, in building the instruments, how much of it, or any of it, were you doing versus your students? I mean, it sounded like Rick was doing a lot of the building. Were you actively participating in any of the kind of physical building, as opposed to just kind of the theory and discussions about the building?
The hands-on, no. I was involved in design.
Okay.
But Rick and the machine shop were involved in sticking it together. Yeah.
Okay.
And so I was following it all very closely.
Right.
But I had probably 10 people in my group at that time, and I was trying to work on funding and everything. So most profs at that point in their career are not too hands-on,
right?
But they can be minds-on.
Yes.
And I certainly was with this project. I knew it was important.
Now, did it seem like your lab and the research of your lab kind of very quickly shifted over into doing mass spec oriented things, or did it continue? Did it have kind of multiple research paths that it was on?
The students who had started off on other projects, of course, kept doing them until they were done. But all the new students that came in started to do mass spectrometry. Yeah.
Were you getting different students? I mean, obviously new students, but were you finding that you were getting students who are maybe physical chemists as opposed to analytical chemists now?
No.
Okay.
Not particularly.
Okay.
But, no. There's, as far as I know, it's the
right.
same sort. Yeah.
Well, we've been talking for almost an hour, and perhaps it's a good time to take a break for a couple minutes.
Okay.
Get some water and things like that.